Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, April 9th. Republicans and Democrats averted a government shutdown. I'll have more on this next time, as well as Congressman Paul Ryan's plan for 2012 and beyond. But for now, what is truly pathetic about our system is that it took Congress all this time to agree on a budget for the remainder of the fiscal 2011 year, which is already 6 months old. I love how people just by rote say we are a great country. No, we aren't. We have some outstanding people, like those serving in our armed forces. But for years now, we have hardly been a great country. But before you get all over me for this statement, I'm staring at the world map in front of me, and only a handful of prospects for greatness catch my eye. Perhaps Australia and New Zealand, though I'd need to give this far more thought. Some of the Scandinavian countries could qualify, but they're so damn expensive. Canada is a contender. That's about it. I like to take each year as it comes in terms of forecasting, but I've been giving 2012 a lot of thought the past few months, and I want to get down for the record that we will have a market crash next year, a big one, 30% or so over the span of just a few days. And it will all be because a switch will go off around the world that there is no way America is going to deal with its deficits. Everyone is thinking about it today, no doubt, but market reaction has been minimal, such as 3.6% on the 10-year. That's hardly a reaction. You may recall I wasn't always this gloomy. At year-end, just last December, after President Obama reached a compromise with Republicans on extending the Bush tax cuts and throwing in a payroll tax cut as a stimulus, I wrote the following. Looking at 2011, I won't be the least bit surprised if at some point in the first half in particular the market is up substantially owing to the stimulus. It would also be a real shot in the arm if the new Congress and President Obama got together on deficit reduction. Sending a message that both sides are serious could cause stocks to soar, and I still believe this. Back in those heady days, I stupidly thought our president would use the State of the Union to begin to educate the American people on the deficits and the exploding entitlement issues that threatened to bankrupt us. This was the time to do it, I thought, it being a non-election year, and if the financial markets thought Congress and the administration were serious, there'd be every reason for the street to rally big. The dollar would be rallying, too, as foreign capital flooded into the good old U.S. of A. By Jove, they're beginning to get their act together, I assumed investors would muse. Alas, that proved to be one hell of a dream on my part. As for why the stock market is still rising with all the problems we face, including $112 oil and soaring commodity prices, it's a fool's game. I've been careful to say I didn't expect a big down year, just 5 to 7% for equities, but today there remains zero reason for optimism. Be my guest. Play Fed Chairman Bernanke's game of taking on more risk. I have my own ample equity investments, but not one of the more substantial plays is in this country. I'm not a trader, and I'm looking long-term, but be very careful, friends. We might skirt by this year with smoke and mirrors, but we will pay the piper sooner than later. So let me just touch on a few key issues of the day. Chairman Bernanke, who none of us should forgive for ruining the lives of the elderly, the prime savers, and keeping interest rates at zero long after the true financial crisis had passed, because he wants all of America to be investing in the stock market to build up a wealth effect, also said, quote, inflation will be transitory, and that prices, quote, will eventually stabilize. I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't say I tend to agree with this. I have no opinion on gold or silver. I actually love silver going higher because it means more web traffic from my article on the Hunt Brothers and the silver bubble. But on other commodities, save oil, which is high for geopolitical reasons, we are witnessing an incredible bubble. My bet is the CRB index, of which I did an update for my Wall Street History column, which closed the week at 368, will still finish the year below the 12/31 close of 332. I see no reason to change my tune on that one. Why? Because I told you this last spike will indeed be the tipping point for the economy. Demand will then fall, and many of the commodities in the CRB will absolutely collapse as these speculators are wrung out. In the meantime, while prices continue to rise, I can look like a fool. Of course, commodities are also rising, including oil, because of our collapsing dollar. And here the only thing saving stocks is that the decline has thus far been orderly. The dollar is falling, just in time for a coming trip to France. Thank you again, Chairman Bernanke. Not because the European Central Bank has now raised its key lending rate for the first time since 2008 to combat inflation, while the Federal Reserve is perceived to be dithering and not facing reality on the price front. Additionally, the dollar is dropping because of our dismal fiscal situation as Obama works his magic and trillions suddenly appears on the wrong side of the ledger, the red side. Why would any overseas investor take a chance on America these days given the fact we are heading to budget Armageddon? Congress' latest move is encouraging, but I just don't see the political courage to enact anything near like the Ryan plan of $6 trillion in spending cuts. Friday afternoon, Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas President Richard Fisher said the central bank faces a significant risk of providing stimulus for too long and should weigh curtailing the final stages of QE2, the $600 billion bond purchase plan that is to end in June, barring QE3. Fisher said, "We at the Fed are near a tipping point. Just as we pressed on and doing our duty through extraordinary exigent measures, we must now discipline ourselves to just as persistently normalize operations in a timely way." Earlier in the week, speaking to how Bernanke has screwed savers, Fisher said, "Americans who have done everything right, have worked hard, saved their money, and stayed out of debt are the ones being punished by low interest rates. That state of affairs is not sustainable for a long period of time." At least someone in a position to do something about our sorry state gets it. It's now up to Fisher to jack Bernanke up against a wall and get him to understand that the funds rate should be 1.5 to 2%, not zero. Moving quickly to such a level would not kill prospective home buyers, as mortgage rates would rise far less than short-term rates. Plus, it's not as if record low mortgage rates have helped the housing sector any as it is. But it would rally the dollar big time and kill the commodities speculators, which in turn would kill this inflation issue of ours. Then again, I didn't go to Princeton like the chairman did, so I apologize for wasting your time with my uneducated opinion. Meanwhile, back to oil. Thankfully, there are some economists who understand that $112 oil is a killer. Mark Zandi of Moody's Analytics said the surge in oil prices since the end of last year is already doing significant damage to the economy. All you need to know is that the payroll tax cut has merely gone into the gas tank, while in a poll for APGFK, 2/3 of Americans say they expect rising gasoline prices to cause hardship for them or their families in the next 6 months. It's also going to do a number on many a corporation and their profit margins. And not for nothing, but why is it the financial press seems loath to talk about how just about every economist on the planet is rapidly scaling back their growth forecast for the U.S.? We're talking a standard year-end projection for the first quarter of 2011 of 3% is now 2% or less. The first half was supposed to be the high growth period for the year. I based my own forecast on a big slowdown in the second half that would hit earnings estimates as part of my projection for a down year on the street in terms of equities. Today, there is no reason to believe the Middle East, for example, will suddenly break out in song, linking arms from North Africa to Iran while doing a Coke commercial. I see it getting worse. Why? When I took a look at 2011, end of last year, my focus, aside from China, was on two countries, Pakistan and the Lebanon. They've been my two real hotspots to watch for some time now, Iran being an extension of Lebanon through Hezbollah. So guess what? I'm not totally surprised stocks have continued to rise despite all the turmoil in North Africa and the Middle East, because my two picks to upset the apple cart haven't rolled over yet. But they will. Oh yeah, they will. While Lebanon and Pakistan are not energy exporters, the chaos will just engender more uncertainty. The Islamists continue to make headway in Pakistan, and there is zero reason to believe the military can prevent a decapitating strike on the heads of state there at some point. While in Lebanon, once the Special Tribunal for Lebanon formally issues indictments against members of Hezbollah and possibly Syrian regime elements for the 2005 assassination of Rafiq Hariri, it's Katie bar the door. Before I wrap up this segment, though, just a few thoughts on Europe. In Euroland, Portugal's caretaker government cried uncle and went running to the EU and, by extension, the International Monetary Fund for a bailout, somewhere in the neighborhood of 105 to 125 billion by most estimates, prompting church leader to say, now, isn't that special? Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, Constantine, Seamus, and Ricardo, as opposed to Manny, Moe, and Jack. All told, they will be in hock to the EU et al. For about $250 billion once the EU approves Portugal's bailout plan. Of course, this is $250 billion in loans piled on top of hundreds of billions in existing debt, and at interest rates the three countries can't afford. Plus, they have to grovel and beg for their loans. But to receive them, Germany and France, the two leaders of the EU and the European Central Bank, demand that Greece, Ireland, and Portugal fire all the remaining civil servants. Plus, the three have to levy all kinds of new taxes. Plus, the ECB just hiked interest rates, so all the homeowners with variable rate mortgages, bigger in Europe than in the US, get screwed yet again. Why, it's the perfect recipe for growth, which is what they need to get out of their mess, right? Of course not. But this is what the fringe Euro 17 members face. It's nuts. There was a simple solution. Default. Pay senior bondholders 70 cents on the dollar and start over. Happens all the time to people and corporations around the world. But as I have discussed ad nauseum, it couldn't happen in Europe because you'd be defaulting on the big European banks, and then we'd learn these emperors of finance have no clothes, and we'd have the bank run to end all bank runs. And I might as well repeat some of my other points since the crisis first hit. Like, it's going to be real good when Germany and France have new socialist leaders in 2012, right? Wrong. Hell, even Portugal's socialist, now ex-prime minister, couldn't get his austerity program through parliament. Mr. Socrates was booted out. What's funny is that for its bailout funds, now Portugal is going to have to enact even more of an austerity budget than what was turned down before. Isn't that just super? Oh, and remember this about $125 oil, which is what Europeans are paying. Try the equivalent of $9 plus per gallon, which is the minimum all their drivers shell out these days, thanks to huge taxes tacked on at the pump. That's real conducive to growth too, right, sports fans? So it is any wonder yours truly remains negative on the continent's prospects, let alone the fact I didn't see one economist this week, amid the happy talk that Europe is going to pull out of this, mention that when you have tens of millions of dissatisfied workers and pensioners who have now either lost their jobs or are about to or will at a minimum have their pensions slashed, you'll have trouble in the streets, which is in its own way not conducive to economic growth. In fact, it's downright depressing. But I'll issue my own report card on this last bit by end of May. And finally, there's Japan. Last week on page one, I wrote, quote, this country will see another severe earthquake this year, close quote. Thursday's 7.1 was indeed the biggest aftershock since the March 11 disaster, but this isn't what I was predicting. I continued last week, quote, obviously another 7.5 or greater in a different part of the country has the potential to bring this nation to its knees as if it isn't already. But I also can't help but comment on the anchor on CNBC, who upon hearing Thursday's quake was reduced from a 7.4 to 7.1. Humrumpfed, he's a big blowhard. Well, understand that the 9.0 quake was technically over 700 times stronger than the 7.1. And why would this upset me so? Because you all know by now, and Mark Haynes should have known, that it's not always the number, it's the depth of the quake that really matters. That was part of the issue on March 11 in terms of generating the tsunami. I would like Mr. Haynes to go to Christchurch, New Zealand, and ask those good folks how strong the quake was that destroyed their beautiful city. Try 6.3, Mr. Haynes. Christchurch lost nearly 200 people, and its offices tumbled down despite having the strictest building codes because the quake was shallow. This kind of irresponsible reporting needs to be condemned. Japan's quake on Thursday was in the dead of night. There were a few reporters on the scene. He's spouting off in his declarative know-nothing fashion. I've been hard on those who are painting far too rosy a picture when it comes to Japan's future. We all want to see the best, but then there's reality. So what did the Japanese government say on Friday? Quote, Japan's economy is suddenly in a severe condition due to the effects of the earthquake. The Cabinet Office statement read, the government is asking major companies to cut electricity use in the peak summer months by a quarter, just as I've been writing. Turning to the week in stocks, got off to a solid start with Texas Instruments' acquisition of National Semiconductor for $6.5 billion, a 78% premium to National Semi's closing price. And later, March, same-store sales for retailers were better than expected, though Kohl's were down 6.5% and Target's 5.5%. But rising oil prices and uncertainty over the budget shutdown helped lead to a flat market in the end, with the Dow Jones adding all 4 points to 12,380, while the S&P 500 and NASDAQ were each off 0.3%. First quarter earnings start coming out this week, and the street awaits any news on margins and the ability or inability of corporate America to pass on rising commodity prices. As always, I have a ton of other information on the geopolitical front. So go to stocksnews.com, click on Week in Review. Have a great week. I'll be back with you next Saturday.